Thinking about Xander led the song "Take Time to Be Holy," and I'm remembering the story that's told about the song leader that announced that we're going to sing "Take Time to Be Holy," but because we're running late, we'll only sing one verse. Sometimes we kind of miss the point of some things, and that's the case with a lot of things. A lot of the things that Jesus tries to teach. We get bogged down in details. We get bogged down in arguments about semantics sometimes. And we can't see the forest for the trees. And we miss his point. He teaches his disciples about being disciples. And he talks to them about the need for them to overcome their instinct. Our instincts are something that we pride ourselves on being above that. We're above these primitive instincts. We are people of a mind with reason, and we're not like the animals. We can think things out and we can make choices on our own. But how often are our lives guided by our instincts? At certain points, we get so tired that our body forces us to sleep whether we want to or not. We get hungry and our body tells us it's time to eat. We have so many instinctual things, but especially when our lives are threatened. There have even been cases where someone who was contemplating suicide. They were thinking they were going to kill themselves, but when they were threatened by someone else, the self-preservation instinct took over. And the person who was going to kill themselves instead did everything possible to stay alive in that circumstance. That's how powerful instincts can be. And of all of the instincts that we have, the instinct for self-preservation is one of the strongest. Just let us get into a life-threatening situation and the body goes into flight or fight mode. It goes into a situation where the adrenal gland begins to produce the hormone epinephrine. Our blood vessels constrict, our digestion stops, our heart pounds, pupils dilate, muscles are oxygenated, and instinctively the body prepares us for whatever's to come. And people in this kind of a circumstance have done amazing things. You hear about people who have lifted vehicles off of someone else because of this life-threatening situation. But can we turn that off? No. Can we force ourselves to overcome that to some degree, or any instinct? Yes. We may not ever conquer them entirely, but we can push those things down. There are examples of people who, in a life-threatening situation, act not in the natural instinctual way. There are those who run into the fire, who stand in the line of fire, who jump in front of the bullet to save someone else, who overcome their own instinct for self-preservation to help others. Jesus certainly was an example of that. He willingly went to the cross, died, knowing what was going to happen. For us, he overcame his instincts. And he talks to the disciples about these things here in Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. We'll look at a little bit of that throughout the way. First, he starts here at the beginning with his first of the passion predictions, the first predictions of his coming death. And it starts with Jesus asking them, again, who am I? This has been one of the themes in Mark. Even though Mark told us right at the beginning, here's who Jesus is, it continues to be the theme of, okay, who is he really? Peter, of course, comes out with the right answer. You are the Christ. Even though others were confused, others thought he was John the Baptist or Elijah or some other prophet, Peter says, you are the Christ. And now, from this point on, Mark's gospel takes a turn. Before, it's been building up to who is Jesus? Who do people think he is? Who is he really? And okay, now Peter has said, you're the Christ. He's stated the fact clearly. But now Mark wants to answer a different question. Now that we know who Jesus is, what does that mean? First, in everything, we establish the facts. We have to learn things. We have to know things. Once we know the facts, then we start to wonder about, well, why or how or what does that mean to me? And that's what Mark does. He starts with laying out the foundation for the Messiahship of Jesus Christ. But once he's laid that out, here he takes this turn and he asks the question, what kind of a Messiah is this Messiah? What does it mean to be the Christ? And as soon as Peter says, you are the Messiah that we've been looking for, Jesus turns that upside down and says, I'm not the one you're looking for. I'm not the one you think I am. Because the very next thing that Jesus does after he says, you're the Christ, he says, don't tell anyone. And then in verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected and be killed and rise again. Now, of course, we've heard before, this is not what the Messiah they were expecting. They wanted the Son of David was going to come and he was going to be a mighty king like David. He was going to kill the giant Romans and reestablish Israel as the reigning power in the region. And so these are the kinds of things that are flowing through Peter's head when he says, you're the Christ. You're the one who is to come. You're the Son of David. You're the one who's going to restore Israel to power. We know the disciples continue to struggle with this all the way, even until after the resurrection, they still struggle with this. When they go, when Jesus is actually going to leave earth, they come to him and they say, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel now? They still did. Even then, they didn't get it. But here, Peter has a totally different concept of what Messiah ought to be. And because of that, Jesus, as he predicts his coming death, he uses a word that, oddly enough, is pronounced die in the Greek. But it's a word that means something is necessary, needful, something must happen. And he uses this word to describe four things that have to happen because he is the Messiah. And those four things are, it's necessary for the Messiah to be rejected. That seems backwards, doesn't it? The Messiah should be welcomed with open arms, but no, Jesus says he's going to be rejected. And then secondly, he's going to be killed. I'm sorry, the first one was that he's going to suffer. Then he's got to be rejected. He's going to be killed. And then the fourth one is that he's going to rise again. Now you would think that they would take hope in the fact that he was going to rise again and that would be the key that they were looking for. There are no more parables here, no more riddles, no more cryptic statements. He just clearly says, I'm going to suffer and be rejected and be killed and rise again. And it has to happen. It must happen this way. Surprise! They misunderstand. Well, it's not much of a surprise if we've been reading along through the Gospel of Mark, because they've misunderstood all along the way. It's no surprise. people today still miss it. There is a large portion of the religious world today who is still waiting for God to reestablish the kingdom of Israel. They're still waiting. 2,000 years and they still haven't got that. Jesus didn't come to do that. He came for a completely different reason. So how do the disciples misunderstand this? We see it very clearly in Peter's reaction. Peter, the very one who's just said, "You are the Messiah." And then Jesus says, "Here's what the Messiah has to do. The Messiah has to suffer and be rejected and die and rise again." And do you know what Peter does? Does he say, "Oh Lord, how can I help you fulfill your mission?" No. Does Peter say, "Who can I tell about this?" No. What does Peter do? He, it says, rebukes him in chapter 8, verse 32 and 3. He rebukes Jesus. Now it's interesting, this word rebuke, this word is epitomeo. And epitomeo is a word that is used 9 times in the Gospel of Mark. And it isn't just a mild disagreement kind of word. This is the word that Mark uses to describe what Jesus did when he told the demons to get out of somebody. Jesus rebuked the demons. This is the word that's used when Jesus rebuked the wind and the waves during the storm and made them calm down immediately. This isn't Peter just saying, "Jesus, are you sure about that? Or is there some way we could avoid that?" This is Peter saying, "Jesus, you are so wrong. This is never going to happen. What you said must happen can't happen." That's what Peter's reaction is. Now, after just saying that Jesus is the Christ, that seems a little odd to us, doesn't it? And yet that's exactly the way Peter responds. Peter sets out to correct Jesus, to improve Jesus' vision of the future. And he doesn't stop to think about the fact that once he said, "Jesus, you're the Messiah," he gave up the right to define what the Messiah was to be and to do. You see, once we claim Jesus as our Messiah, as our Lord, we give up the right to make any more demands on who He is. We acknowledge that He's defined that and that He is who He claims to be. But Peter didn't understand that. And so because of that, Jesus has to turn around in verse 33 and rebuke Peter in return. "Peter, you going to rebuke me? Let me rebuke you, because you're the one that really needs to be rebuked here. You're the one that is wrong." He condemns Peter. Notice in verse 33, "Get behind me, Satan." Matthew's version of this interaction is even more powerful in some ways, because there when Peter proclaims that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus says, "Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you. This wasn't man's thinking. But God revealed this to you." This is God's thinking. And then he turns around here and he says, "Oh, but you're like Satan. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of men." Do you see how quickly Peter's mind turned around? One minute he's proclaiming the things of God and not the things of men. And the very next minute, he turns right around and starts thinking like a man again instead of thinking like God. How quickly and easily does that happen to us? How often does our human instinct kick in and we change our way of thinking? We talk about faith and trusting God and all of that while we're in Bible class or while we're in worship together, and we sing songs about how we stand in awe of Him. And then we walk out the doors and completely forget all of that and start worrying about what we're going to do about a situation instead of leaving it in His hands. How often do we do that? I don't know about you, but it's happened to me so many times I can't even count. To where just like Peter, I come and I speak the words of God and think the things of God while we're together and worshiping Him, and then I turn right around and start thinking like a human again. But Jesus calls His disciples not to think like humans. He calls on us to think like He thought. To view Him as He viewed Himself. Jesus says, Peter, you're thinking the things of men instead of the things of God. He in essence says, you know, Peter, you're letting your instincts, you're letting your human nature take over again. You're not being a child of God. You're acting just like a normal man would act and not like one of my disciples. You're going to have to overcome your desire to protect yourself and to protect me. And you're going to have to let things happen the way they're supposed to happen. And it's hard, isn't it? It's been a problem all throughout history. Jeremiah told the Israelites, the tribe of Judah, that Babylon was coming to take them and they needed to surrender. And you know what they did to him? Counted him as a traitor and threw him in a pit. Because they just couldn't stand the idea of surrender. And on again. Time and again, people's reaction has not been what God's reaction wanted, what God wanted their reaction to be. It's always been their own. It's always been their own instinct. But you see, Jesus defines not only who He is as the Messiah, but He defines who we are as disciples. What does it mean? What is the meaning of discipleship? You see, a suffering, selfless Messiah requires His disciples to be willing to be like Him. Requires us to be selfless and sacrificial as well. And that goes against our human nature. It goes against that self-preservation instinct. And of course, we need to understand that self-preservation instinct was given to us by God when He created us. So it's not that the self-preservation instinct in and of itself is evil in some way. It's not like it came from the devil. God created us that way. But He calls on us for certain reasons at certain times. He doesn't just say, well, quit caring about life at all. He doesn't say, you know, well, we should all kill ourselves. But He does say when it comes down to a choice between doing what pleases me and what pleases others, you've got to sacrifice self. We talked about this some in class this morning, and it was brought up. You've got to put your will under God's will. You've got to make sure that He gets His way. It's the only way. And so Jesus gives a condition for discipleship here in verse 34. If anyone, and notice He makes it, He doesn't say, if you 12, He's not just talking to the apostles. If anyone wants to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. If anyone wants to go after Jesus, there's only one way to do that. I know the religious world today may give us 57 different paths to try to get to heaven. But Jesus said, there's only one way. You're going to have to deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. That's the only way that you're coming with me. You see, we don't get to decide how Jesus rules. Maybe it's because we've lived in a democratic style of political system, living in a republic as we do, where we get to vote on things and we think our vote matters. And it does in our political system, but it doesn't when it comes to Jesus. It's an absolute monarchy. He decides. We don't get a vote. Our only choice is, will I submit or won't I? If you're going to come after me. Notice he includes the crowd in this. He looks to, calls the whole crowd to him with his disciples. He doesn't limit this. This is anyone, anywhere, anytime who wants to come to Jesus. You've got this condition that you've got to follow. It's a universal condition. You deny yourself. A selfless abandonment of yourself to the will of God. You take up your cross. You are pursuing that which will very well lead you to death. And you follow Him. Imitate Christ's example. Be like Him. Think like Him. Act like Him. Speak like Him. Instead of the natural human way. So in verse 34 he gives the condition. But in verses 35 through 38 he gives some reasons. He gives four reasons that it is vital to choose to follow Him instead of our natural instinct. The first in verse 35 is that it's the only way to save your life. You've got to lose it if you want to save it. The second in verse 36 is that one life is more valuable than the entire planet. The whole world is not worth as much as one life, one human soul. The third thing in verse 37 is that in fact a life is worth more than anything in the universe. He asks the question, what would a man give in exchange for his soul? We talked about that a little in class this morning too. People exchange a lot of things for their soul. Unfortunately, they get a bad bargain every time. Because there is nothing that's more valuable than your soul. And then in verse 38, he closes out by bringing it very clearly home. Shame now is going to bring shame later. If you're ashamed of me, then I'm going to be ashamed of you. On that last day, when I come back in glory with the angels and in the glory of my Father, I'm going to be ashamed of you. I'm going to not admit that I know you if you haven't admitted that you know me, if you haven't followed me. He calls on us to live above our instincts. And this is such a transformational concept. Sacrifice yourself? That in fact, in the next few verses, it deals with the transfiguration. The disciples needed a powerful message to really help with this. And Peter, James, and John get to go up and see Jesus with Moses and Elijah standing there. And they're still not clear that Jesus is the One. And so God has to speak from heaven. And He says, "This is My Son. Listen to Him." There are a lot of people in the world today hollering. A lot of people that we could be listening to. But God calls on us to listen to His Son. We could be listening to our natural instincts. But God calls on us to listen to His Son. And His Son calls us to rise above our instincts, to think differently than other people, to sacrifice self instead of seeking to save self. He calls on us to think like He thinks. It's a challenge. There's no doubt about it. Jesus doesn't call us to do something that's just so easy. The old saying, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. Jesus calls on us to do hard things. He calls on us to do the things that only the few who truly believe in Him, who are truly devoted to Him, who truly accept Him as the Messiah, as He defines being the Messiah, not the Messiah they think they want. There was the philosopher, I believe it was Voltaire, could be wrong about that. He said, God created man in His image, and then man returned the favor. And far too often, we try to create Christ and we try to create God to be who we want them to be, instead of who they truly are. We are to mold our minds and our thoughts to them, not try to force them into a mold that we've created. If you're here this morning, if you haven't turned your life over to Christ, if you haven't given your will over for His, if you haven't denied your own instincts to do what He wants you to do instead, what are you waiting for? What are you trading your soul for? Because whatever it is, it's not worth it. Make that decision today that you will follow Him and you will give over everything to Him. If you have a need to respond to God's invitation this morning, please do so as we stand.